This is Issues and Ideas. I'm your host, Larry Rutter. Today, our topics range from social media to police officers' hairy companions to a pernicious fever.
We were running in this county probably 70 to 80 cases per year, 2007 through 2008, 226 in 2011, and 163 in 2012. This year we're probably running along the same line. So the case increase is something that's been observed throughout the entire Southwest, including Arizona. A lot of people would like to know why we're having that increase.
We'll begin with Lynn Deal telling us why Valley Fever isn't confined to the Valley and the latest approaches to diagnosis and treatment of the disease. Then Donna Cheek comes in and visits with a local canine officer and her dog.
He does. He actually works off of me. So if I'm calm and I'm sitting here talking with somebody, he's calm and mellow. If I'm, say, anxious or nervous or act up for some reason, like if we were working and we were on a scene or something, he would be a little bit more pumped up and anxious knowing that he's working. He knows his environment and he knows the difference.
And then Brian Reynolds. He explores the use of social media and social networking as tools for businesses.
There's a great story. It was a Korean taco truck, which I'm not sure what that is, but it's a very famous Korean taco truck in L.A., and every morning he tweets, "I'll be on the corner of this and this." By the time he gets there, there's 300 to 400 people in line. Only 200 get fed, and that's how Twitter works.
First, let's talk disease, its prevention and treatment.
It is commonly called Valley Fever, as in California's Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley. But make no mistake, the cause of Valley Fever, the fungus, is lurking on hillsides and in backyards, at the coast and in the desert, and lives outside its geographical namesake. The fungal spores are native to not only hot, dry climates in California, but also Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, central and southern Mexico, and South America. I'm Lynn Deal for KCBX Issues and Ideas. Valley Fever. The familiar name doesn't say it all. It is not nearly expansive enough for the increasingly numerous cases being recorded each year. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, more than 20,000 cases are now reported annually. Dr. James Beebe, the director of the San Luis Obispo County Public Health Laboratory, says San Luis Obispo County is not immune to this rise in numbers.
We were running in this county probably 70 to 80 cases per year, 2007 through 2008. Then in 2009, actually, 2010, we saw an increase to 152, then to 226 in 2011, and 163 in 2012. This year, we're probably running along the same line. So the case increase is something that's been observed throughout the entire Southwest, including Arizona. A lot of people would like to know why we're having that increase.
The question of why may be followed by how many. Some researchers think the fungus probably infects more than 150,000 people a year, many of whom are sick without knowing the cause, or they have such mild cases that they go undetected. Would you recognize the symptoms? Dry cough, fever, muscle aches and joint pain, rash, headache? The symptoms could be easily attributed to the flu or other illness.
Like most guys working outdoors, I hardly ever get sick.
Dave DeBusk is a vineyard manager in Paso Robles. As a farmer, he's outdoors at work and at home. A few years ago, healthy and in the prime of his life, he started feeling unwell. It was difficult to breathe, and there was the achiness and terrible joint pain.
You just have this real tightening of the chest, like somebody's pulling a belt around your upper torso. It's just you can't just get enough air to keep going. And pretty soon, the fever came on, sweating. And I can remember, Lynn, lying in bed and trying to be as still as possible, not trying to move a finger, because every time I moved anything, it was the most horrible arthritic pain you can imagine.
Dave went to the doctor, and testing didn't identify Valley Fever.
Days after being prescribed antibiotics, he still wasn't feeling any better. Soon, he developed a skin condition, and when the laboratory did a culture...
And lo and behold, 24 hours later, they called the house and said, "We have a problem. You need to go see this guy right now."
So why did the first test fail? Well, the disease had already disseminated, meaning it had moved, spreading to another area of his body. In Dave's case, his skin. He underwent active treatment for months, and he began to feel better. But the periodic checkups, tests, and scans would continue as he was monitored for any changes. He feels fortunate that he underwent treatment in time.
Gosh, how fortunate could I be? If I was walking around thinking that these antibiotics were working and it was picking on something else, we might be having a different conversation, or you might be having it with somebody else.
The scientific name for valley fever is coccidioidomycosis, or COCCI for short, and it is clearly present in San Luis Obispo County. Infection can occur year-round. 30% of the people who live in what's called an endemic or native region are exposed to the fungus at some point during their lives. The fungus produces spores. When inhaled, they lodge in the air sacs of the lungs. In most people, the infection goes away. Others aren't so fortunate. They develop severe infection, chronic pneumonia, and it can be deadly.
When somebody has a dry cough that lasts for a number of weeks, with perhaps a transient fever with a rash, they need to see their doctor.
It is not transmitted person to person. There is an increased risk for developing the severe form in certain groups of people. Pregnant women, people with weakened immune systems, people of Asian descent, particularly Filipinos, and African Americans. It is not confined to humans. COCCI is also present in animals.
I have identified it in so many different species. I was a zoo veterinarian, and one of the first cases I saw was an orangutan with it in his heart and heart sac. Since then, I've identified it in polar bears, in coyotes that are indigenous to the area. I've identified it in mountain lions, and certainly lots and lots of dogs.
Veterinarian David Edsel had extensive experience with the disease when he moved to Atascadero from Tucson, Arizona. Currently, his practice is actively treating at least a dozen cases. Typically, once COCCI enters the body, it can go anywhere, causing any number of symptoms, and the animal can't tell us how they feel.
Generally, the way it's contracted is through respiratory form, through a respiratory infection. But the amount of time that an animal may cough is very short in duration sometimes. It may be very minor as far as that goes, but then once it enters the body, it can go anywhere. I would say the second most common place that we identify it after the lungs, where the primary infection is the bone. We see it in bones, mostly long bones, but several other types of bones in the body. And so it'll arise and cause bone pain and bone infection, and that can cause either limping or fever, malaise. We see draining tracts sometimes, and that can be, I've seen it in the face, in the skull, in joints, and in many other places.
Coccidioidomycosis is under public health surveillance in 15 states. Why are the cases rising? Is it more awareness, more testing, more reporting, weather conditions, or changing weather patterns? Dr. Benjamin Park is the chief epidemiologist with the Mycotic Diseases Branch, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He explains it begins with the fact that it's a reportable disease.
What that means is that cases of valley fever that occur in California or Arizona or other areas in the United States are reported to the public health authority. In turn, those cases are reported to CDC, and CDC compiles these reports and issues findings about the incidence and the epidemiology of the disease. What we've been able to show over the last 10 or so years is that the incidence, meaning the number of new cases of valley fever per year, has gone up dramatically in many areas of the country, including California and Arizona. For us to count a case as a case, there are a number of steps that have to happen. Patients need to go to the hospital or to a physician, and the physician needs to diagnose it correctly, and then that case ultimately needs to be reported to CDC. When we see changes in the incidence like this, our first question is, well, is this something called an artifact, which is really just kind of a spurious finding in the way that disease disease is reported, or is it really due to an increase in disease? And we're still trying to understand this better. We think that we have some preliminary signals showing that this is actually an increase in true disease, but we need to look at what the contribution is of things like better diagnosis and better reporting. It's certainly possible that some of those conditions and those factors could be influencing the rise, but it's also possible that there is actually an increase in real disease. So it may be actually a combination of many things.
One medical officer called it the forgotten disease, out of sight, out of mind, until it crops up close to home or work or play. It is back in the California news headlines because of two clusters of cases, including that of more than two dozen workers infected by Valley Fever at two solar power construction sites in eastern San Luis Obispo County on the Carrizo Plain. The second case is that of prisoner deaths attributed to Valley Fever at Avenal and Pleasant Valley State Prisons, reportedly more than three dozen. The receiver in charge of running the prison system has directed the state to immediately remove more than a third of the inmates at those two prisons on the basis that they're at risk of becoming ill. The California correctional system is asking the court to delay or block the order. The U.S. District Court is scheduled to hear arguments June 17th. As a lead investigator at the CDC, which is collecting data regarding the prisoner cases, Dr. Park can't directly comment or share information or opinion about that case. I did ask about the apparent differences in transmission in general. One at the construction sites where digging was occurring over a large area, and the other cases which seemed to be passive and airborne occurrences.
The fungus, as far as we know, is not present everywhere in the soil in these areas, but it exists probably in little pockets. And so if you're unlucky enough to go in the backyard and want to plant something and dig up the wrong area, then you can get exposed to these coccospores. And on a greater level, if you have larger construction projects like the one in San Luis Obispo, then there is a potential for having more spores aerosolized after these large construction projects with digging. The other way that people get cocci is just by walking down the street and being outside. You know, we know that these spores can become aerosolized through natural means, through wind picking up dust particles and spores that happen to be on the surface of the ground. And then when these spores become aerosolized, people who are just outside doing whatever can become infected because it only takes a few spores to actually get infection.
One protective recommendation is to wear a mask when working outside in endemic areas, and the right mask, properly worn, may offer some defense. But the spores are microscopic, which brings us to Professor John Taylor in the Plant and Microbial Biology Department at UC Berkeley, who's seen plenty of them while suited up in a safety level 3 environment.
Have to be extremely careful.
The John Taylor Lab studies the pattern and process of fungal evolution. Over the years, he and his research teams have discovered cocci in kangaroo rat middens in the Carrizo Plain, used genetic sleuthing to identify the migration of the pathogen to South America from North America, and documented evidence of species divergence. But we began our interview with the very basic question from basic biology. What is a spore?
So give us the scientific definition.
Spore is a part of an organism that can be transported by the wind or water and move that organism to a new place. So the analogy that probably makes the most sense is like a seed of a plant. But a spore is simpler. And typically from a microscopic organism, a microbe. It could be a bacterium, but it's very, very common in fungi.
When did they become part of the Earth environment?
Well, the fungi evolved, or the lineage leading to fungi, originated probably about a billion years ago. And the oldest fungal spores that we have fossils for are about 460 million.
More than a dozen years ago, he and his researchers started using population genetics as a tool to study coccidioides. And the first thing they found was two species, one in California and northern Mexico, and the other east of the Sierra Nevada, in Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Texas, stretching through Central America to South America.
And what's interesting about the Texas South American population is that there's very little genetic variation between individuals of the fungus in Latin America and Texas, which indicate that they migrated, that fungus migrated to Latin America as much as 100,000 years ago or as recently as maybe 7,000 years ago. And so we think it's possible that it migrated south along with the human migration.
What researchers are finding is that the species in Arizona is exchanging genes with the one in California, creating a hybrid. In its age-old quest for survival and reproduction, Coxie found a home in small mammals. In field research on the Carrizo Plain, Dr. Taylor says it can be found, but not as easily as one might expect.
If you go to places where these mammals have their colonies, for example, kangaroo rat colonies on the Carrizo Plain, and you collect soil, you can find spores of Coccidioides in the soil. You can recover it. However, it's not easy because the fungus stays with the mammal. When the mammal dies, the fungus makes the spores, but it makes them in a very patchy way then. So if you just go out and start digging, the likelihood is you won't find it. You've got to search and find colonies of the mammal.
It would seem that intentionally unearthing it is more difficult than unintentionally finding oneself in its path. The disruption of soil in large areas or by earthquakes and wind events increases the chances of spore dispersal. Health experts say if a person suspects valley fever, they should see a doctor and ask to be tested. Despite years of research, there is no vaccine yet. I'm Lynn Deal for KCBX Issues and Ideas.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. This is a program that tackles a wide range of topics that concern our area, heard every Wednesday from 1 to 2 o'clock. In a bit, Brian Reynolds will be talking with an expert in using social media to enhance a business.
So most people just talk to their phone or talk to their car and say, find a coffee shop. So this coffee shop's not on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Siri doesn't recognize them. Siri is the voice activated. It started with the iPhone, but now it's in most new model cars. So you, instead of typing your search parameters, you ask Siri.
But now, as always, we're pleased to go to the dogs.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas. Today, my guests are Canine Officer Stephanie Pippin of the Morro Bay Police Department and her partner, Cello. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. You know, the last time that I saw Cello, he was all business, running drills at the park in Morro Bay. And that was a really, really interesting experience for me because, as we had talked about, my background is horses. To see dogs going through their drills and their exercises, it was entertaining. It was impressive. I was struck by the level of intensity. I was struck by how smart these dogs are. How long have you and Cello been together?
We've been a partner for about a year and a half now. Cello's our first patrol canine. I met him when he got off the plane, actually from Germany, last January, so maybe even less than a year and a half. And our bond has become very, very close, as you saw with me when I handled him at our training, and the other officers that were there as well with their dogs. We have a very tight bond. We're like a family.
That's what I noticed, and I also noticed the level of affection.
Yes.
That there's a lot of love between the handlers and their dogs.
They do it for the affection, for the love, or for, if you saw the toy that we
yes,
played with them,
I did.
They're like a kid. So if you talk to a kid and you play with them, you get them all excited, they're going to stay excited and want to learn and be with you. And the dog is pretty much the same way. Once they do something good and we encourage them, we want to play with them and give them those happy, loud voices and like you do with a pretty much like a child. And they'll continue to want to work harder for you and be with you instead of being stubborn, because they could be just as stubborn as kids as well and not want to work with you.
You said this was the first time that Morro Bay has ever had a canine officer?
Cello is the first patrol German Shepherd canine Morro Bay has had.
Interesting.
And when I say patrol, he is trained in narcotic searches, apprehension, finding and locating evidence or people, and pretty much tracking anything
really?
That we really want him to track.
That is impressive. And
yes.
He is lying here in the studio, very relaxed, very handsome. Quiet.
Very quiet.
He won't be saying much to us today.
But... he knows what he's here to do. He's just here to look pretty. He's not working, but he's here to look
pretty. That was going to be my question.
Uh-huh.
He knows that being here is not work.
Right. He does. He actually works off of me. So if I'm calm and I'm sitting here talking with somebody, he is calm and mellow. If I'm, say, anxious or nervous or act up for some reason, like if we were working and we were on a scene or something, he would be a little bit more pumped up and anxious knowing that he's working. He knows his environment and he knows the difference.
He's big, Stephanie.
Yes,
he's
very
a big boy. And that's one of the things that I noticed. I noticed that you were the smallest out there at the park. And Cello was the biggest.
Yes. I do not know how that happened,
really?
To be honest with you.
Was it? Okay.
I went to, when I got him off the, when I first went to training, I was with another five or was it six other police officers and their dogs, whether they're sheriff's department officers from all over the county, actually different counties. And they ended up pairing me with the biggest dog and I was the smallest person. I have to lift the dog up.
Wow.
I couldn't lift him up. I mean,
why do you have to lift him?
Because we have to be able maybe to walk up a ladder. Say to go on a roof or go on an attic. I have to be able to put him up on my shoulder and get him up there so he can look for the person or whatever he's doing. And 105 pounds is a little heavy. So I could get him down. Now he's down to 95 or 100. His ideal weight is about 90 to 95 for me. These dogs are also trained to be carried. So they kind of fold around your shoulder.
Correct.
But they're trained to just, if you get them in the right spot, they kind of fold and they just hang there like, okay, they don't like
they
it. But they drape.
Instead of fighting you.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. Out of all the other police officers at the Morro Bay Police Department, how is it that you were chosen to be a canine officer?
Well, there's a certain testing period and certain criteria you have to meet. And obviously, you have to want to be a canine handler.
Okay.
And out of Morro Bay, we had about three or four other officers that wanted to be. And we had to go through the testing period. You had an oral exam. You had to meet the chief. You had to do different things. And you had to meet certain criteria. And out of all the people at the time, that's what they were looking for, is the qualities that I ended up having.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas. We are talking with Canine Officer Stephanie Pippin of the Morro Bay Police Department, and she's in our studio today with her canine partner, Cello. The other thing that I wanted to ask you, how did you and Cello meet?
I didn't get to bring him home and meet him and play with him before we went to training.
Okay.
The day I met him was in Ventura.
Okay.
When they got him off the plane and brought him to our training facility in Ventura,
right.
Which is Inglis Police Dog Academy. And when we were there, we got to meet him like in a field kind of a thing. And he got to come up and we got to be one-on-one playing.
Correct.
He didn't want anything to do with me.
You knew when you got there which one was going to be your dog?
At the time, yes, I did.
Because he is an imported German Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
There were several dogs that came over from Germany with him.
What they do is they fit the dog to the handler. And they fit Cello to me perfectly. Granted, he's bigger.
Yes.
But we have a great relationship.
Okay.
Cello looks to me as kind of like a marriage. But he wants to protect me. He wants to please me because I'm a female handler. So he's like, I'll do anything for you, Mom. You know, what do you want me to do when you want me to do it? And then when he doesn't listen, he knows he's in trouble.
Yes.
More so than if it was a female dog, I'd probably be butting heads with a female dog. Because, you know, female and female.
Thank you.
We butt heads a little bit more.
You know, Stephanie, that's so true because I found that out with mares. My harmonious relationship was with a stallion.
It's very similar. I think horses and dogs and the training and the way they act are very similar in many ways from what I've talked to other horse handlers. Because if you have the wrong kind of dog and you butt heads,
correct,
it's going to be very difficult to work in the field with that dog. And liability reasons and stuff, you want to have a dog that works well with you and that you work well together and not one that you're constantly fighting with. And you don't have the same kind of personality, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, it's matchmaking.
Yeah.
And it has to be his temperament is compatible with yours.
Yes.
Because it sounds to me like he has a lot of responsibility when he's working.
Oh, he does. So if I have my patrol uniform on, he smells it, he's getting excited, we're getting in the car, we're going to work. And as soon as the windows roll down in Morro Bay, when we roll into Morro Bay, he's whining, he's excited, because he knows a couple things. He gets to go to work, he gets to go training, he's with me, you know, a full 9 to 12 hours, how many hours we work on that day, and he loves it. Yeah.
So then you meet, and were you able, like, okay, great, this is my dog, you take him home? What's the process?
No, from then on, we had a five-week-long training period that we went to. That was our first meet.
5 weeks solid?
5 weeks solid, back to back. And okay. We meet the dog there, and then we go into training. And there's baby steps, obviously, because you're trying to build a relationship, just like anything. And then after the 5 weeks is over, that's when we hit the streets. We go back to Morro Bay together, and we're a team. And we teach the officers also how to work with the dog as well. My other partners need to learn how Cello works. Whatever it is, they have a special tail.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Tail.
Tail.
That's one way of putting
Literally
it.
Literally tail.
They have a tail to tell.
Exactly.
Do you go back to Ventura for tune-ups or follow-ups? Or?
Well, from there, I have other training that I've went to. I mean, we had narcotic training that was a four-week-long class that we're raising money for is to go to our last training class, which is a hard surface training. He's trained for vegetation searching.
Okay.
But hard surface training is a more technical kind of a search. I mean, he has to find a certain scent on the asphalt and track it. So we have one more course we're going to go through from that. So we'll go to that training like what you saw in Morro Bay. They come here locally once a month.
Okay.
And then I go to Ventura once a month as well.
Oh, so twice a month. Honing skills.
Yes, because Cello's like any of us. If we don't continually train our skills that we don't work on a regular basis,
you're right.
He will possibly forget them, or he won't work on them the right way, or he'll get lost. So
won't be as sharp.
And because of what he's training in, such as apprehension or narcotics, it's something that you have to train on a regular basis to continue to stay sharp. And there's always something new.
Wow.
We do something different every time we're there. This last one I met you, we actually went in a boat with the dogs.
I saw on Facebook.
Yes.
That's the other thing that we need to mention is that there is a Facebook page. Okay, Friends of Morro Bay Canine.
Yes.
Is Cello's Facebook page.
Yes. Like so it. And you can follow us online.
I noticed that he made an appearance at the Woods Critter Camp.
Yes, he did.
I noticed that on his Facebook page.
We'd got the opportunity to speak with about 10 different kids, and we taught them how to be safe around dogs. So we did a little demo with them. They got to play with Cello, and they got shirts. We're going to be going to their next critter camp as well. It's a great opportunity for the kids to meet a police dog and not be afraid of them. And we teach them not to be afraid of them. We do a lot of different demos. And through Facebook, I tell everybody, like, this past weekend, we went to the Morro Bay Car Show.
How are Cello's expenses paid for? How does that happen?
He is 100% by fundraising through the community.
That's
how we keep him on a yearly basis. So I have to raise,
important.
Or he has to raise, about $5,000 to $7,000 a year.
So that's why he's working.
Exactly.
He makes appearances.
He does.
Signs paw graphs.
Pretty much.
And
gives little licks.
And so I like how you are introducing him to the kids so that they can see that certain circumstances he can be friendly.
Yes.
And they can have a respect for him as the officer of the law.
Yes.
But yet not a fear, because it can be so intimidating to see them working. So speaking of Cello working for his keep.
Yes, for his keep.
I wanted to ask you, what is happening on June 22nd?
Well, June 22nd is our third annual canine dog walk. About 3 years ago, we started our dog walk, and that was to help bring funds to Morro Bay to get Cello. And we had to raise $60,000 back then. That was for the dog and for the patrol car and all the training. And within 10 months, we were able to raise that $60,000, which is amazing. And we thought it was going to take years to get that.
Wow.
But that's how much the community wanted the dog, which is very heartfelt and awesome.
That is awesome.
And the canine dog walk helped us do that. What it is, it's a dog walk where people could bring their dogs out and they do a walk through the city. And then after the walk, they come back, and we have 10 to 15 different vendors, and we'll have a doggy carnival, which has been awesome through the 3 years. People love it. Well, we have a doggy cakewalk, or we have a doggy food eating contest. We have doggy instead of bobbing for apples, it's bobbing for balls, where they get the toys and we keep the dogs involved. So it's not just human related, it's dog related. And at the same time, we have canine demos this year, and we started last year because we had Cello, and they are unlike any demo that anybody has probably seen here on the Central Coast. We do apprehension demos. We do two dogs biting a suspect at once. We have pursuit demos, and we do them throughout the entire event. So we have from obedience all the way up to the big pursuit at the end. If you've never seen a police demo, come out to Morro Bay on June 22nd because it's pretty awesome.
It sounds that way.
And he'll have his friends also out there, the ones that you saw out at canine training.
Really?
We're going to invite them out there, which are okay. from other departments. Also, we'll be doing like raffles to help raise money. We'll okay. have our shirts to also fundraise.
That's
Woods great. Humane Society will be there. And if somebody would love to walk a dog or wants a dog that day, they could adopt a dog, or we're renting a dog.
Perfect.
For the dog walk, which is pretty cool.
Yes. So don't let that stop you.
No, don't right? let that stop
don't
you.
Don't have a dog. Rent a dog.
That is and so the nice. Funds that they raise through renting that dog go towards Woods Humane Society and go towards Morro Bay Canine Cello. It was a huge success when we started it, and it's continually getting bigger and bigger with the Humane Society attending our events and offering that to people.
That service, that's very nice. I like to hear about other dogs coming to support Cello.
Oh, yes.
And participating.
And we have a great group. We all come together and support each other, which is
that's
awesome.
Nice. And the dogs know each other.
Our dogs are all trained to ignore dogs because
makes
they're
sense.
A working dog. So they're not allowed to socialize to the level as our house dogs. Now, when he gets retired, he's going to get spoiled.
And I understand in talking with the officers at the park that the officers are able to just purchase the dog for $1 when the dog retires.
Yes, we are.
And they are able to have them for the rest of their lives.
Yes, however long the rest of their lives are. But they're putting their lives on the line for us. They go into a building before we do in case there is something. So we have to think about that, you know. If something bad happens in that building, they're there and their life is going to be taken before us. As much as we love our dogs and yes. we don't want that to happen, but that's what our patrol dogs are there for. They'll do anything for us, which still boggles my mind every time I think about it.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, for coming in to talk with me today and for bringing Cello in to visit and for pictures. I'm hoping that you have a great turnout
Thank
for
you.
Your third annual dog walk event in Morro Bay
yes.
on June 22nd.
Yes.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Now, we join the director of the Slo County Libraries, Brian Reynolds, and his guest.
Today, we are joined by Terry Bayos, who is an entrepreneur in social media and social networking, and also Los Osos Branch Library Manager Joe Lorenzi. Today we're going to be talking about social networking, people interacting with people on a personal and a business level, and also about the role of social media in that mix. As we know, everything computers is ubiquitous, it's important, it's growing, it's changing, and so we feel this is a very important topic to discuss. Since Terry Bayos is a business consultant and business owner and screenwriter, among our other talents, she's also very interested in social networking and the role of social media in that. Could you tell us a little bit about your business and what some of your main focuses are, Terry?
At the current time, I teach social marketing for businesses classes. I came from the advertising world, and when social media came out, I was really excited because I saw an opportunity for the very first time for businesses to brand themselves with themselves and not with traditional media. For example, if you run a newspaper ad, you're branded with the newspaper. This was a way for truly the raw, authentic voice of a business owner to get out to their customers and possible customers.
Is it safe to say or restate what you said, that it takes away that intervening layer and more or less puts the business owner in direct contact with the customer?
Exactly. I mean, all business owners that are brick and mortar hope for someone to walk in the door. And with social media, you have that without them walking in the door. You have that layer there where you can directly talk to them, you can explain things, you can promote yourself, you can do anything that would be the same as having 5,000 people standing in front of you.
If you had a physical business, you would hope you'd be in a district of town, let's say, or a mall, where customers would pass by and see your store. How does a business get noticed on the internet?
Well, on the internet, we use the social media. There's 7 or 8 different big platforms. There's Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Pinterest is the third largest social media site at this point, and YouTube and blogging. And with using all of those different platforms, you will gain different focus groups and different interest groups that will come to you that wouldn't normally drive past your store.
I'd like to know more about the individual platforms, like Facebook and Twitter. and Pinterest. I've seen them all. I've looked at them. I personally don't have accounts. What do those look like, and how do they help people?
Well, there's two different realms. There's the personal realm of them, and then there's the business realm. I teach and deal mostly with the business realm. So on Facebook, Facebook is a place where you have a page where people can come and be a fan. And so, and it's a place where they can interact. So if your business is, say, having a sale or has some special item come in, you can say it's there, and then people that bought it will say, yes, I bought it, and then it will engage other people. Well, what did you think about this? And so Facebook is more of a conversation. Twitter is more of a, it's only 140 characters, and so it's more of a, say you owned a taco truck and you want people to come to your taco truck, and so you say, I'm going to be on the corner of, you know, Hollywood and Vine this morning, and there's a great story. It was a Korean taco truck, which I'm not sure what that is, but it's a very famous Korean taco truck in L.A., and every morning he tweets, I'll be on the corner of this and this. By the time he gets there, there's 300 to 400 people in line. Only 200 get fed. Wow. And that's how Twitter works. Pinterest is more of a virtual pin board, and it is, once you get on it, you can't walk away. It's virtual hoarding, for lack of a better word. So if you are you're a business, then you can put up your products, your ideas, but you can also put up your concepts. Like I went to Thailand this year. I was doing a culinary trip there. So I put, before I went, all the places I would like to go, pictures of it, and you put the pictures up, and then if the person's interested in it, they click on the picture and it takes you back to the source website. So it's a way of putting a business's personality out there without words. So Pinterest works very good with that. LinkedIn is more of the business side of it. It's the bare bones. This is who we are. This is what we've done. This is, you know, it's a very business platform, but also a very good way to establish yourself as an expert. Say if you even have a, say, a secondhand baby item store, you can establish yourself as an expert on LinkedIn because you read articles and write articles and do things like that. And then there's YouTube, which is just the video portion of it. YouTube is currently a larger search engine than Google. Most people go to YouTube to learn how to do anything. My husband just changed something in my Jaguar that was like near impossible to do before. But he found somebody with a video camera over his shoulder and walked through and was able to save.
Like a video encyclopedia.
It is. It is. And so anybody does anything, they put it on YouTube. And so all of them reach different people and different needs, and then they all work together. They feed to each other. So when I Twitter, it goes to my Facebook, it goes to my blog. They all kind of work within and then all land on your original website.
That's so interesting. I use YouTube mainly for music, and I kind of get lost looking at videos of bands and different genres. But many, many times my wife and I have used YouTube and the internet to understand how to repair a bicycle, how to bake, make a special dish, you know, cooking.
Right.
And weaving. She uses it for weaving as well.
Right. So if you were a yarn store, then you would go on YouTube and you would put all those weaving things on there, which establishes you as an expert. So
you can see the techniques. How much training do people need? Does it vary by the site? For example, can anybody who's a little computer savvy use all of these sites, or do they need special background or workshops on how to post and manage their accounts?
Anybody can do it. My mother can do it, so anybody can do it. But it does take a different – it definitely takes a business state of mind because you're still operating as a business. So what I teach in my classes is how to use the platforms correctly, how to use each of them individually in the correct way. And it's pretty easy to sign up. I would encourage all businesses to sign up because our world is run by Siri now, whether anybody realizes it or not. And if you're not on all of these sites, if your business is not even at least signed up for all these sites, Siri can't find you. So most people just talk to their phone or talk to their car and say, find a coffee shop. So this coffee shop's not on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Siri doesn't recognize them.
So Siri is, just for listeners, it's a...
Siri is... the voice activated that started with the iPhone, but now it's in most new model cars. So you, instead of typing your search parameters, you ask Siri where to go.
You're like asking a librarian, if I may be so bold.
Exactly.
An online virtual librarian.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're not in the Dewey Decimal System of the internet, which is social media, she's not going to find you. So
I'd like to remind everyone that this is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. We're talking about social media and social networking with Terry Bayes, who runs a business and teaches in those techniques, and also Joe Lorenzi, branch manager for the Los Osos Library. Do you think, Terry, that the social media have changed the way people have interacted with each other? Because it is a computer interface. Does it change the way they interact? Do they make more friends or more business connections? Are those qualitatively changed from before this era?
I believe yes, in a good way, because before, when I would run into somebody that I hadn't seen in a while, it was just, hi, how are you? Now I know for a fact that her son just went to school and her dog was at the vet. Instead of the hi, how are you, it's like, how's the dog doing? It's taken us a leap forward that we really are vested and interested in other people's lives like we never were before. Anybody who follows me on Facebook knows everything my grandson or grandkids ever did or said. You know, that may be to the disliking of them, but that is my life right now. That's what I see. That's what I do. So I do think that it's a good thing. I think it's encouraging us. I ran into someone the other day. It was a Facebook friend. He walked up and said, Terry, I've never met this man before. He was just a Facebook friend. He recognized me, and we all of a sudden were friends in a store talking, and we knew a lot about each other's life. I think he's one of the DJs here, actually, Jim Gonzalez.
Yeah. Are there any cautionary sides to it? For example, if you're, let's say your life were some laundry and it's hanging on the line and everybody can see it, does that make people vulnerable to, say, other people with bad intent? Is there any way to protect that, or things that business people or parents should know about this?
Well, definitely. I mean, you should treat it as if you were standing in the room with your grandmother. And if you wouldn't say it with your grandmother there, you shouldn't say it. There is the element of when a business makes somebody angry, there are ways to retaliate. But with each of the sites, there's ways to maintain that and to manage it. If you get a bad review on, say, Yelp, my suggestion is to answer it very positively. I'm sorry, I understand, and try to have a conversation with them.
That's really good
privately
advice.
And because what I've found is when I had a business and I got a bad Yelp review, it was somebody was mad of some other reason. And what happened was that instead of taking it off and arguing, my customers came to my rescue. And I had 7 good things said about me that I wouldn't normally said, defending me against this individual. So you just have to manage it the same way that you would your life. If someone comes in and they're yelling at you, you wouldn't, and you're a business person, you wouldn't yell back. You would say, I understand. Let's talk about this. Let's do it in a calm voice and move on from there.
So normal social etiquette would also rule in the area of social media.
Oh, yes.
You said the word management of your sites or of your platforms. How much time goes into that? What can people expect to when they manage all of these things?
Well, when it's done correctly, it shouldn't be more than 5-10 minutes a day. In the beginning, it is a little more intense because it's like learning a new language. And you have to be careful not to go down the rabbit hole where you're putting something up and all of a sudden something interests you and you've just wasted an hour of your life. So,
is there such a thing as over-twittering?
Over-tweeting?
Over-tweeting.
I don't believe so, but you're asking the wrong person.
I mean, will people do you, like? Is there studies, or do you know of like if people stop following if you don't like do it correctly? Or,
yes.
Is there a nuance to it all?
There is a nuance to it. There are certain times during the day when you should Twitter, Facebook, and Pinterest. 9 o'clock before 9 o'clock in the morning. If not, then they're lost because typically people get to work, check all these things, and then get to work. And then at the end of the day, around 4, again they stop what they're doing, they check everything, and they move on. Typically, if you're not posting at least once a week, yeah, you will lose interest. People don't necessarily unfriend you or go away, but they do lose interest. It's about keeping a conversation and being as interesting as possible. So the more you're, you know, there's a restaurant that every morning, he's just a bacon and egg restaurant, nothing fancy, bacon and eggs. Every morning he tweets a post that says, come on down and try our bacon and eggs. He doesn't get too fancy. He, you know, there's never anything more than just really good bacon and eggs. But that will remind me every now and then when I am interested in just bacon and eggs to go in there. So I see him every morning, and I'm like, good for you.
if you're reading tweets from businesses, how much for the reader will that be invested, or the consumer, do you think?
Well, I read tweets more than I answer emails. And Silicon Valley, now there's, I think, 54 businesses that have outlawed emails within their business. All employees and all customers must communicate via tweets.
Whoa.
So all of those offers that we opted in, like I want the Babies R Us offers and those type of things, I never responded to those, even though I opted in. But if Babies R Us tweets that they've got some special thing in, I will respond to that. So I don't think that I don't think you can overdo it. And I think it is going to take the place of email, because email is sabotageable, at where Twitter is not.
Wow.
That's an interesting concept. I mean, if we use the term hacking, which when we first got into automation, a hacker was simply a person who was adept at with computer technology. It was a benign thing, but now we think of it as malign or malicious. So there's different platforms that are more protected against bad things.
Yeah, and all of these are. They're very protected. And if you do, for some reason, someone does hack your Twitter because there's whole industries that are making money off of doing this, you simply change your password and move on. And there's no damage done, because each of these social media platforms only have a shelf life of about 3 hours, and then they're gone.
I see.
So unless you do something really bad and somebody gets a screenshot of it, and then it lives forever.
Is there a moderator or somebody who kind of referees these things?
No.
Just self-governed?
Yep. Yeah, there's a perfect example right now of the worst. It's called the worst social media meltdown ever in the world. And it was a restaurant in Arizona, and I guess they were on that Chef Ramsay show. They brought Chef Ramsay in to try and save the restaurant, and yelled at him, called him names, admitted stealing from their employees, did a whole bunch of very horrible things. And they decided to take it onto social media, and all caps, yelling at their customers, calling their customer names. I mean, it was the worst breakdown train wreck I've ever seen.
I saw that on
and I can't
Yahoo.
Walk away from it. But it's these people are the epitome of what you should not ever do. They don't stand a chance of ever surviving their brick and mortar, because, you know, now what they did was they opened up and let everybody be a fan on their Facebook page. So they made a comment last night. They did a press release. And within 24 minutes, there was 1,000 comments to their press release, not one positive.
You know, there's a theory of literature that dysfunction easily becomes art. In other words, if you write about everything being happy and wonderful, it's not that engaging. I'm thinking also the reality shows that my wife watches, that they're not people who are at their best.
Right.
You know, and so I think there's a certain attraction for those train wrecks, metaphorical train wrecks, that is on some level entertaining.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, and the beauty of social media is it's still such an unknown that when I'll tweet something that I'm sure is going to resonate with people, it falls flat. It's crickets, nobody. And then I'll put something just random. Like the other night I got home and there was nobody at home. I had a dress on and I couldn't get out of my dress. So I tweeted, somebody come and zip me. I'm stuck and I can't get out. 2 weeks later, people are saying, did you ever get out of that dress? It had nothing to do with anything, except for I personally was at home stuck in a dress. So
interesting.
You write for some local papers.
I do. I write for Tolosa Press, which is the Coast City News, Slow City News, and the Bay News.
Tell us about, since we're librarians, tell us about your writing experience and what are you using for that?
Well, I write lots of different things, and that's why social media is so easy for me, because it basically is a platform for writers. If you're a writer, it's very easy to engage in social media. If you're not a writer, it's a little more difficult, which is one of the techniques I help teach people, because if you're not a writer, then putting things on paper is like a sixth grade essay. It's murder for them. I write a dinner and a movie column. So each week I go see a movie and pair it with a dinner. All over the county.
Yeah. I didn't know that was you.
That's
okay.
Me. I've been a food critic for probably 20 years regionally and in national magazines and stuff. And I wanted to have something that was local, that was immediate, because writing is a very lonely, long marathon. And so about 6 years ago, I talked to Tolosa Press into letting me do this article. So I go and eat at about, you know, 3-4 restaurants a week and see a couple movies and pair them together.
Do you go incognito?
I do. And very few people know what I look like.
Yeah, because you wouldn't want them to be putting on a special dish because you want to see it as any yeah. customer would.
That's unfortunately happened a couple times, and my fans and are not fans, but the readers are very savvy to, hey, we went in there and we didn't get the same experience that you did. So I'm very, you know, incognito. I eat there about 3 or 4 times. And once I know I'm going to write about it, then I do introduce myself to the chef or owner. And
after.
Yeah. And then they restart their heart, and I'm like, I swear it's all good.
Yeah, you know, there's this whole issue of if you go to a play or you go to a restaurant or whatever and it's not a good experience, what's your obligation? Is it to tell people about that or to spin it in a positive way? And I don't know if that debate will ever be settled. I would do want to mention something at this point that librarians know that I don't know how if a lot of other people do know that there's generally a disconnect between what people want to know about things local and what's available to know. A lot of times the internet can be more about global issues, the newspaper ditto. A lot of times those issues are negative, you know, like a car wreck or something. But we have always found there's a huge interest in things local, but because there's not a lot of profit in it, it's not there aren't that many choices or it's not well organized. We did a state library grant a couple years ago on what kids were interested in and kid agencies like YMCA, 4-H, and it turned out among their varied interests, the number one by far was to have a social media network for teens in the county so they could get to know each other and also know what was going on by way of entertainment or education or whatever, hobbies. And so I think this is very pertinent to what we're doing and what you're doing and others do to promote knowledge of local issues is huge.
Oh, yeah. You know, like this morning I got on Facebook and Twitter to figure out where the race was because I knew I had to come from Pismo to here and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to get stuck with the race. Well, unfortunately, it's in segmented parts and I missed one of them. I took the wrong route.
Oh, but, boy.
It's your website is terribayus.com.
Yeah, TERIBAYUS.com.
And what can people expect when they go to look at the website?
Well, they can, you know, a little bit of my ADD. I do a lot of different things, and you can see copies of my blog. I have 2 different blogs, one that's just a jump up for writing, so it's really, really a raw voice without editing because I live in an edited world, and sometimes it's a little frustrating for me. So even though the punctuation isn't correct, I like to just get my raw voice out there.
I'm okay with that.
And then my social media, all my platforms are on there. The special events I do and all the different hats that I currently am wearing and doing.
And some of the special events that I read about and some of the things that you're doing with local businesses, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I do special events for nonprofits and I help manage nonprofits. So basically, we just did one for Fort Hope, which is this wonderful 1800s western town out in rural AG in Wasna, where they bring at-risk kids there and they have a whole day of being what it was like in the 1800s. They fish, they do archery, they shoot BB guns, they make rope, they pan for gold, they milk a cow, they do all these things. And so it's this one day where at-risk, either sick child or foster kid, you know, grizzlies, learn what it's like to succeed and work with their hands and just get out of the minutia that is their life and have this wonderful old-fashioned day.
Grizzly cadets, not grizzly bears.
Yes, grizzly cadets.
Yeah, the Grizzly Academy is amazing. I'd like to remind everyone that this is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're discussing social networking and social media with Terry Bayes and Joe Lorenzi from Los Osos Library. Terry, what do you see as the changes in social media coming up in the next, say, 5 years?
I do see that there's one website called Instagram that's really kind of taken over, which is picture-based. I do see with the interest in Pinterest and how it's growing that you're getting more of the sense of the person with their pictures. What I like best about it is it forcing everybody to write again, where everybody has to write. If you're doing any of these things, you have to write. So kids that would have never written anything past sixth grade are now having to write full blogs, having to write their experiences and completely enjoy it.
You know, to a librarian, that's music to our ears because writing and reading, we think, are essential skills. And a lot of times kids don't get a good grounding in writing and reading, or they may see books as a chore and not a pleasure. And so that makes me real excited to hear about the writing element.
Yeah, and I've seen teens on there share books where they wouldn't normally do it. You know, I just read this and it really changed me. And then the comment on a book in print without a teacher forcing them to do it, I think it's fantastic. So
I think book clubs on the internet, huh?
Yeah, my daughter belongs to like four. They share books. It's peer groups. They introduce each other to other books and authors. They encourage the people to write the author and thank them, which I think is the greatest thing in the world, because as an author, you sit in a room by yourself a lot. When somebody sends you kind words, it's like, oh.
We do a lot of things at the library where we'll visit a school or even at our own libraries, and all of the kids in the same school will read the same book or something like that. And it's overwhelming, like how much they talk about the book, how much they know it. And like if anyone's able to get the author to come visit, you know, it's like a rock star's coming.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's so encouraging. I don't know if people would know this, but once in a while I would send a favorite author. I would talk to their agent or their publisher and ask if I could send them a book to have it autographed, like for somebody's birthday, say, or for myself. And almost always they'll say yes.
Yeah.
In fact, they're flattered. And I've actually had correspondence with some pretty famous authors who are flattered because they don't hear from their readers that much.
No, and we really don't. And so it's very, very nice when we have one of us put together a thing where it was write your favorite three authors, write them a letter, live or dead, write them a letter.
Oh, that's great.
And almost all of us received signed books back. We didn't ask for anything. It was just, this is what you did for me. This is how you changed my life. Thank you for writing this. And we all got really, really encouraging things back. So
I was telling Joe earlier that I read a book recently called Click. And it talks about how people use the internet. And there's some very big surprises in there that young people will look for prom clothes months in advance. And there's a cycle for that, for example. But it showed that most people don't contribute to the internet. They look, and there's maybe 2 out of 10 would actually create. But I think in terms of YouTube and social media, that would be just the opposite, that almost everybody would be contributing. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I have a 13-year-old nephew that's always had trouble reading and writing. It's always been his crux. But he's on Facebook, and he's telling people what it was like to water ski at the lake and what it was like to do this and how he's writing and posting and blogging and putting YouTube up almost daily, which I don't think we would ever gotten out of that child.
That idea, Terry, of kids becoming more socially involved or learning new skills, as a parent myself, that makes my heart go pitter-pat.
Yeah. I was very excited to see him on there all the time because we thought, you know, he was just going to be this little 13-year-old by himself, no friends. Now he has all these friends, and if he can't sleep, he goes on there. Anybody awake? And his aunts, uncles, you know, grandparents are there talking to him, where we normally wouldn't be able to do that.
I'm getting a vision of like this nice balance of where people are engaged in, say, a book or some other form of media, a movie, and now they are also creating. So it's not only that they're reading and writing, but you know, now they're writing and participating, and it just sounds like there's potential for this.
Well, it sounds multifaceted. It isn't just sitting in front of a e-device, but it's using that for a variety of things, making new friends, having new adventures.
Well, yeah, and when you're explaining one of your experiences, whether it be a food, a movie, or an event, you're having to pull from all sorts of creativity that you didn't have before. What the sun looked like, what the flowers were like, what the crowd looked like, which would be much more than, well, I went to a concert. They explain the whole thing, and I think that it's pulling a creativity open in their brain that we didn't have before.
Wow, that's so exciting. My name is Brian Reynolds. I'm the director for the San Luis Obispo County Library. And today we've been joined by Terry Bayes, who is a social media networker, teacher, writer, a very amazing person. She has her website, Terry Bayes, TerriBayus.com. And we've also been joined by Joe Lorenzi, branch manager at the Los Osos Branch Library. Thank you.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Join us every Wednesday when we explore the people and concerns of Southern Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties. This is Larry Rutter.